Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the very important battlefronts of that war for the free world is in our own hemisphere. It is Venezuela, and each day the situation there is becoming more dire, and the implications for both the region and for us more obvious. A man we turn to regularly to help clarify what's going on there and the implications for the rest of us is the president and editor-in-chief at the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is also the head of International Investment Bank Caracas Capital Markets. He has been the president of Venezuela's The Daily Journal as well. He is, of course, Russ Dallin. Russ, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much, Secretary Gaffney. It's always, I always learn so much. I think I know so much. And then I always come out of these discussions with you in your Socratic method, learning so much more.
Well, thank you very much. I hope our audience does as well. Listen, talk to me about the latest on Venezuela. We're seeing these unbelievable out-migrations from its destitute and starving people. This is clearly having repercussions for their neighbors. The countries in the region are beginning to respond in various ways. There is now new evidence of corruption at the highest levels involving the Maduro family itself. What's the state of play as you see it, Russ Dallin, and the implications?
It is amazing how fast things are happening and changing. This week, Venezuela did some shock therapy that would have been understood by Westerners had it not just been another half-hearted attempt at doing so and have the name in, look like a Western capitalism in face only, though. They raised the minimum wage, which you and I have spoken on many a time, on occasion, from under $2 a month to $30 a month. And they did that by a couple of different ways. But of course, they didn't raise the prices. They froze the prices. So they increased the wages 60-fold. They, at the same time, they devalued the currency by 96%. But then they told anyone selling anything that you couldn't raise the prices. So guess what the natural reaction to that is? No more production, right? Because everything just went haywire.
Longer lines.
Yeah, it just it's almost like they had a whiff of proper economics, and then to top it all off, they pegged their currency, the Bolivar, to the Petro, a cryptocurrency that is neither crypto nor a currency, that is this notional currency that doesn't exist, that the U.S. government has prohibited any U.S. companies or persons from being at all involved with, and it doesn't trade anywhere. It doesn't really exist. Yet, you know, they might as well have attached it or anchored it, the currency, to unicorns, because it doesn't make any sense. So when you have hyperinflation like Venezuela is going through,
1,000,000%, we're told.
Yeah, 1,000,000% is what the IMF is projecting for Venezuela, and I tell you, after this week, they're going to hit it sooner rather than the IMF would have thought, because the stupidity it never ceases to amaze one.
We could go on about the sort of symptoms of the problem, but talk to me about two things, Russ. The fact that millions of migrants are now simply seeking refuge elsewhere, and how they're being received now. The magnitude of this tragedy is just stupefying. And secondly, what steps we're taking to hold accountable the government, specifically the Maduro family itself?
So as you and I have discussed before, there's also, as a result of the fact that you cannot live in Venezuela because you just there's not enough food or money to pay for yourself, much less your family. So the way people have been voting is the way they do in all proper Western societies, by mass exodus. It is estimated now that we're approaching 4 million people leaving that country. They are flooding into Colombia and Brazil. Brazil actually sent the army to the border to close its border for some time over the last week because the flood of Venezuelans bringing all kinds of diseases and measles, for example, that have been eradicated before into the country. The Venezuelans are walking as far as Argentina, just all the way from the top of Latin America, with their dragging their suitcases or with their suitcases on their back, to Ecuador and Peru, which are now shutting their borders to the Venezuelans by requiring passports, which a lot of these poor people don't have. And you can't get from the government anyway, because they don't have paper to actually print the passports on in Venezuela. It's causing a huge problems, of course, in Colombia, which is the easiest country to get access to. So much so that Secretary of Defense Mattis, when he was there last week in Colombia, agreed that they would send down the naval hospital ship Comfort, the U.S. naval hospital ship Comfort, to the Colombian side of the Venezuelan border, where they would start to help all of these refugees who are ill, have no medical care, are sick, malnourished. So the U.S. is trying to help in that way, as well as donating money to help deal with the flood of refugees.
Yeah, it seems like way too little under the circumstances, as you've indicated. I mean, this is a crisis that makes even that in Syria now pale by comparison. Russ Dowling, quickly, the prosecution of people involved in criminal activity in the United States now, but the Venezuelan government is apparently implicating the Maduro family itself. I just want to make sure we touch on that quickly before we have to part.
Absolutely, and absolutely correct, Frank. Your knowledge of these issues is it constantly amazes me. In the federal district court here in Miami, where I'm at right now, the court has just accepted a plea bargain from a Swiss banker named Matthias Krull, who is pleading guilty to being involved in a $1.2 billion scam where they were sucking money and money laundering money from PDVSA. And they were actually directing it to Maduro's and his stepson's, by Celia Flores, his wife. Their accounts, over $600 million went into those accounts, directly linked to the Maduro family. At the same time, also implicated is the head of Globovision, which used to be an opposition bastion, but they gave up because they were getting attacked, and so they had to flee the country and sell whatever they could. So he is implicated in this. They've already seized, get this, I don't know what you have lying around your house, but they seized in one go, in cash, $35 million in one of these people's houses in the U.S. So $35 million just lying around the house as part of a $45 million haul they have.
It's a level of corruption that is staggering, and I'm sure that's just the tip of the iceberg. Russ, we are hard out of time. There's so much more to talk with you about. I'm anxious to do so again. We'll talk with you hopefully next week. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Joe DeGeneva right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It is my high pleasure and great privilege to say, joined by Joseph DeGeneva, one of the rock stars of the legal field and certainly the field in which the law melds with the public interest and safety and national security. He comes to the topics we'll be discussing with him with the background of a former U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia for 4 years. He has served as an independent counsel in a variety of capacities. He's been a chief counsel and staff director on very important committees in the United States Senate, including the Select Intelligence Committee. He has been, of course, much in the news of late, running commentary on some of the most important topics of our time, notably, but not exclusively, involving President Trump's travails and those that are being compounded by the current special counsel, Robert Mueller. Joe DiGenova, welcome back. It is so good to have you, sir.
Nice to be with you, Frank.
Well, I thought I might start, Joe, by asking for your insights into topic A at the moment, which is Donald Trump's personal exposure, even criminal exposure, some would have us believe, in the aftermath of the conviction of two of the people who had previously worked for and with him, Manafort and Cohen.
Well, the Manafort conviction, of course, is about things that happened years before Paul Manafort ever knew or worked for Donald Trump for the 90 days that he was the chairman of the campaign. That said, he was convicted of things totally related to tax law and other things having nothing to do with Trump or the Trump campaign. So there's no Russian collusion in that case. There's nothing having to do with the president. The only thing that involves the president is because the president, as of this morning, expressed deep concern for Paul Manafort and his family. And in an interview, he did not rule out a pardon for Manafort. I think that is perhaps the most important piece of news out of the Manafort case, is that its viciousness by way of both investigation and execution has led the president to a sympathetic position for Mr. Manafort.
And that travail is not over, by the way. Of course, he might be retried on some of the charges that there were mistrials on, and also that we may have this whole another set of prosecutorial tortures inflicted upon him.
I think the prosecutors would not retry him on the 10 counts on which there was a hung jury. That would be viewed by the public as so unnecessary and vindictive, given that they got 8 convictions, which are worth 100 years in prison. I'm not quite sure what kind of brain it would take to retry the other 10 counts. But that said, Mueller's people are kind of weird and vindictive, so maybe they'll do it. And of course, the D.C. case involves failure to register as a foreign agent and all the stuff related to that. I assume that case will go forward unless the president pardons him. But I don't think he's going to do that. I think if the president is going to pardon him, he will do it probably after the midterm elections. With regard to Cohen in New York, this is a fascinating case for me. Mr. Cohen pled guilty to something that isn't a crime, at least the parts of the plea that deal with the illegal campaign contributions, so-called, which involved the president in one count, in that he says in the plea agreement and in the actual plea itself that he did this at the direction of the candidate. And we all assume that the candidate is Donald Trump. First of all, these were payments to, in the form of legal settlements to two women to keep quiet alleged sexual liaisons with the president a number of years ago. These types of settlements are not campaign contributions. They are perfectly legal to make. If they are made from campaign funds, they must be reported. These were not made from campaign funds. And so the question becomes, how did it become a crime for Michael Cohen to make these payments? Well, if you believe that it is a crime, it was because he created corporations to get loans to make the payments. However, what then happened was, according to what we know, the president paid Mr. Cohen back by his regular monthly retainer payments to cover the cost of these settlements. So where we are here is, I believe that what Mr. Cohen did was not a crime. I believe that he pleaded guilty to something that isn't a crime. And he did so for quite understandable reasons, to get himself a better deal. And the prosecutors in New York, which is understandable, wanted to get something out of this thing with Cohen so that they could say that they had touched on the presidential campaign. Now, you have heard some people say that the president is an unindicted co-conspirator in this case against Cohen because of the one count where he is alluded to. That is incorrect. He is not an unindicted co-conspirator. In order to do that, you must be named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the document. And he is not. He is not named as an unindicted co-conspirator, nor could he be under the law.
Let me turn to one other piece of this, Joe DeGeneva, and that is the role that we've seen sort of slowly, inexorably being exposed by this so-called deep state in bringing about these charges against Donald Trump in the first instance, and then creating the special prosecutor's mandate to pursue so-called collusion with the Russians. John Brennan features prominently in what is now coming to light. The president, of course, has revoked his security clearance, and he's being turned into sort of an iconic figure for the left. Do just a reality check for us, would you, on Brennan? We'll talk shortly with Dinah West about some of his personal history, but I without getting into the clearance business, just how would you characterize the role that he's played and his associates?
I would say that when there is ever a criminal investigation of the FISA abuses and the unmaskings that went on of Trump administration people, John Brennan will be seen to have been the lead conspirator, the guy whose idea it was to get the dossier, to create it, to spread it around, to get it up to Harry Reid, to make sure that it got into the press along with Clapper. And I think it's pretty clear that Brennan had an animus toward Donald Trump that was so big, so powerful, that he could not resist, and his hatred was so great that he abused the power of CIA director. He traveled overseas to get information. He dealt with foreign intelligence services in order to undercut the incoming president and to try to frame the incoming candidate for the Republican Party. I think you just saw the other day that James Clapper, perhaps one of the most perjurious people who's ever served in federal government, say that he wished that John Brennan would shut up for a while because his statements were a bit crazy and he was not helping the cause. The problem with Brennan is quite simple. He is emotionally disturbed. He has a very serious problem with his ability to control his emotions when it comes to Donald Trump. It is irrational behavior. It is behavior that is extremely dangerous for someone who has access to very confidential and classified information. And I'm delighted that his security clearance was revoked. He doesn't deserve one.
You know, Joe, I've been talking on the program here about the fact that we've got to get, you know, as Donald Trump says, make America great again and to make America safe again. We need to make security secure again. And one of the things that I think just jumps out at you as you've gone through that litany, John Brennan's personal character, his history, and his judgment raise questions as to whether he ever should have had a security clearance, let alone whether he should continue to have one. But that's a topic for another day. Let me turn to one other thing quickly, Joe, because I do want to cover this before we run out of time. Earlier this week, Barack Obama appointed federal judge essentially threw out any sort of punishment against an individual by the name of Imran Awan, a Pakistani national, now an American citizen, who ran, it appears, to me at least, and I think to others who are pretty thoughtful about this, an espionage ring on Capitol Hill, certainly benefiting Pakistani intelligence, if not run by them, tapping into sensitive information, personal correspondence, other emails, official and unofficial, of apparently a fifth of the House Democratic Caucus. And this judge said that this gentleman, Imran Awan, had suffered enough at the hands, apparently, of I don't know who, that he shouldn't get any time at all for the kind of bank fraud that Paul Manafort's looking at a very serious hard time for, it appears. What do you make of this so-called House IT scandal, Joe DeGeneva, and the fact that we've seen it handled in this bizarre way? Cover-up doesn't begin to describe it.
As a former United States attorney, I look at this and I am breathlessly incredulous at what I'm watching. It is very apparent that there are two systems of justice now at work at the Justice Department. And unfortunately, Jeff Sessions has no way to deal with it because he's completely impotent as a result of the manner in which he became Attorney General. And that is that if you're a Republican, you get treated one way. And if you're a Democrat, you get treated another way. It is as plain, as simple, as stark, and as disgusting as that. I never thought I would hear myself say those words, but the department needs a complete house cleaning. That cannot be done by the people currently in charge. And that includes Jeff Sessions and the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein. Both of these people believe to the core, to their core, that the people of the Justice Department make mistakes, but they do so inadvertently, and that they are basically the greatest people in the world, and they can do no wrong. I am very fearful that they are not going to investigate the FISA abuses criminally with the grand jury, that they're not going to investigate Brennan and Clapper, that they are not going to investigate the unmaskings. I hope I'm wrong, but every ounce of my body and everything that I see and read and sense as an observer for 30 years leads me to believe that they do not have the stomach to take on the people at the Department of Justice that they have known for many years.
Joe DeGeneva, your thoughtfulness and your clarity on these issues is incalculably important. We appreciate you sharing them with our audience from time to time. Please come back to us again very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Diana West is with us, virtually at least. Our weekly visit with her is one of the high points of this program. Diana, of course, is a longtime syndicated columnist, a best-selling author of Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can find her writings these days at dianawest.net and also periodically at the Daily Caller and elsewhere. We're always delighted to have a visit with her. Diana, welcome. It's good to have you.
Thank you. Wonderful to be with you.
Well, I was thinking of you a lot as I was speaking with Vladimir Bukovsky last week. And folks, if you haven't had a chance to listen to that program, I encourage you to go to our podcast at securefreedom.org. It was one of the most illuminating and in many ways chilling hours of conversation on this program that I've had in some 9+ years. And Diana, I thought of you because you've done so much with American Betrayal and your other writings, your commentaries, your blogging, to help us understand in our own time some of the insights that Vladimir talks about, born of his own hard experience with the Soviet Union. I know you had a chance to listen to the interview and to comment on it on your blog. Your takeaway?
Yes, well, I would like to preface it by saying it was a wonderful interview. I thought you did a marvelous job in eliciting his reminiscences and experiences in that hour. I came to know Vladimir Bukovsky through my work on American Betrayal. When I contacted him about it some years ago to see if he would be interested in reading the book, he wrote me right back and said he had already read it. And we went forward. He wrote a couple of very amazing essays about the book as well that ran at Breitbart some years ago. But the point being that what I was trying to document in the American experience resonated so much with him, having been inside the Soviet archives, the Communist Party archives. And this is where the notion of betrayal of both our peoples comes from, in terms of the same communist attack on people and freedom, and that happened here too. And I think that that is what most people don't understand today, that we have this long history, none of this Russian influence, as it is rather ridiculously called, began in 2016. This has been a century-long project, at least, in our country. And when you get into archives, you do discover these things. And this is Vladimir Bukovsky's tremendous witness to this experience, having gone through some fraction, only a fraction, of Communist Party archives in the Central Committee archives in Moscow. And let's bring that right up to date. Look at how the bureaucracies, the swamp, as people have sort of understand it, block the release of documents to this day that demonstrate the malfeasance of lawless bureaucrats. People say, oh, we're so different. There's no comparison. However, there is tremendous comparison. We have the exact same experience in terms of people gaming the system for ideological reasons. And this is something that people understand taking place in openly communist countries, and they don't understand taking place in socialistic countries or social democracies, the sort of milder terms that we use to describe or think of the liberal West, which has been increasingly subverted more slowly, of course, than any sort of revolution as in 1918, but increasingly subverted as our institutions that protect liberties have been stolen from us. And this, more than anything else, I think, is the lesson of this period that we've really had since Donald Trump began to run for president. And this is sort of what we're still not coming to grips with.
Yeah. Diana, let me just ask you to sort of connect dots here. The archives of the Soviet Communist Party, which Vladimir Bukovsky, as you say, had a chance to steal, basically, and review, do make clear the hostility of the communists to the United States. And I think together with your own work, help explain how we've gotten to the present pass, where a generation of American kids has, and some adults too, to be fair, have imbibed so much from the sort of institutions, notably the academic institutions of our country, in which socialism, as it's often described, the sort of entry-level drug, if you will, towards communism and fascism, Nazism, has been, you know, really inculcated to the point where now it's de rigueur to say you're a socialist or you would like to see socialism's triumph here in the United States. Walk us through this a little bit, both from the historical perspective as well as your analysis of the current moment.
Yes, well, I think, again, this is a very long-term project. It's not just a recent generation or two. We can go back and trace this. And this is part of this whole notion of suppressed history, that American betrayal is one little foot in the door trying to open onto this suppressed history or this erased history, this protected history. If we truly go back and start looking at the investigations that were done by elected officials, for example, in the New York State Legislature going back to 1920, that's very, very early, where they're already understanding the influence and deleterious influence of Soviet and communist and socialist propaganda on the school systems, on the political system. We can understand this as a century-long project. If we go to 1940, which was a window of opportunity when the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany were allied, we can look at New York State hearings again and understand that the New York State school system, the public school system, meaning high schools, meaning the city colleges, were already completely subverted by Communist Party members who were secretly, covertly teachers and professors and organizing students. This is part of our lost history. This is a sense of why this is such an effective moment for socialism, because we have had multiple generations, again, many generations of this brainwashing. And it is brainwashing. And we get to this point where our bandwidth of understanding of what socialism is, what our history is, what the history of socialism is that killed millions and millions of people, communism is just another word for it, it is lost. And so you have this tremendous opportunity to further condition the mindset to a point where we accept the ends justify the means. We accept this kind of politicking, this kind of partisan conditioning that continues in our newspapers today. Donald Trump calls it fake news. It is fake news because it is so tremendously political, and it is not about fact-finding. And this has just become inculcated, as you say, in our daily professional, institutional, educational, cultural life. So it's a very dire moment, because it's very hard to get the truth through, which is why, going back to Vladimir Bukovsky, his witness is so important, because he does manifest so much of this experience in his own life and in his life writings.
Right. Well, and so is your witness, Diana West. I have to say, I think what you've done to try to help connect the present to this important, if lost, history is incalculably consequential. And so it's always a privilege to have a chance to bat this around with you. Speaking of fake news and speaking of communists, or at least people who have demonstrated an affinity to them, I did want to ask you about John Brennan, who acknowledged having voted for Gus Hall, the longtime Stalinist leader of the Communist Party of the United States and routinely a presidential candidate. Back in 1976, Brennan voted for him, we're told. We're told that James Comey described himself as a communist. He says he moved on to something else, but he wasn't quite sure what he was now. Nellie Orr, the woman who features prominently in this this so-called Fusion GPS dossier scandal, the impetus behind the whole collusion with the Russians charge against Donald Trump and his campaign, she is an admirer of the Stalinists. I mean, connect these dots, if you would, for us in the present moment to that bitter and lost history.
Yes, well, you've just given a nice brief overview. I will give a little commercial for The Red Thread, which is a work I am completing for the Center of Security Policy, as a matter of fact, which goes into the ideological drivers of the anti-Trump coup. And I think that this is the most important missed story of the past couple of years, because we have been trained to look away from ideology, going back to all the things we've been talking about in this interview in terms of our conditioning. And people are very afraid to get to this place where you actually investigate or consider or debate people's beliefs. They've been hidden. We were afraid of the word red baiter, going back to the whole McCarthyism hysterics and all the rest of that. But this becomes a very important thing to understand, that these are not just generic officials, generic leaders of agencies, or generic Russian experts. These are, it turns out, tremendously ideologically driven people going back to their early years. We know that James Comey described himself as a communist back in 2003 on preparing to enter the number two position at the Justice Department under then Attorney General Ashcroft. We know that. He told New York Magazine that. He was very vague about what he was at that moment going into government. But when you actually go through his thesis that he wrote as a senior, which I've done, you understand that he is exactly in this mode and tremendously driven by these ideas. Did he change? Well, we have no evidence of that. However, we do see in his behavior as FBI director and the rest of it, we see the same lawless ends justify the means activities and actions that can be traced right back to his thesis written as a senior at William & Mary in 1982, which I have actually done. So this becomes a very important addition to understanding what we're looking at.
Diana West, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time today. Next up, we will be speaking with Dr. Mark Schneider. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, visiting with Dr. Mark Schneider, one of the country's preeminent experts on all things involving nuclear weapons, our own and those of potential adversaries. He has come by all of this expertise through decades of service at the highest levels of the United States government, truly the duty expert on such subjects at both the Defense Department, the State Department. He's worked with the National Security Council closely. I had the privilege of working with Mark decades ago myself and have admired him ever since. It's always important to talk with him about such issues because they're all too often neglected by the rest of us. These days, he's a senior fellow at the National Institute for Public Policy, where he is continuing to expose policymakers and the American people to the challenges we're facing, particularly from those governments that we have reason to believe have nuclear weapons for the purpose of threatening us. Mark Schneider, welcome back. It is so good to have you.
Well, thank you very much.
Let me ask you, Mark, of these governments, one, of course, that you have specialized in for most of your career is Russia, the government now doing business under Russia. It, of course, was formerly the Soviet Union. The Russians have been engaged in this massive nuclear buildup for years now, and it seems to be basically coming to the fruition of having essentially modernized the whole strategic deterrent. There is this one weapon system that I particularly wanted to ask you about that has been undergoing a series of tests with decidedly unsatisfactory results, but also potentially horrific consequences. Talk about this nuclear-powered cruise missile the Russians have been developing.
Well, this was announced by President Putin in March of this year. It is almost certainly the craziest weapon system to ever have come out of Putin's Russia, as I predicted when this thing was announced. It's had at least reportedly had a series of launch failures, and that's understandable, because what you have here is an unshielded nuclear reactor in a missile which is like maybe 20 feet or so long, and it's probably destroying the guidance system. Thus far, they've been lucky in the sense that the failures have been early on in the flight, so you don't have the buildup of radioactive materials in the reactor that you would have if it failed later on. But even so, it's very, very dangerous, and there's no reason for it. The rationale for it is not penetrating missile defenses. It's no better than any other cruise missile at doing that. I mean, it's a sort of a fanatic worldview that results in weapons like this, and it's very, very dangerous. The latest reports are that they're going to try to recover one of the crashed cruise missiles.
This is one that was apparently lost at sea, is that right?
Yes. According to the current press reports, they started testing at Kapustin Yar, but then they moved it to a Arctic island, which is where they test their nuclear weapons. And according to this, it failed within a few minutes of launch, which I think is only to be expected on something this crazy.
Yeah. Mark, crazy seems to be sort of operating in a lot of different respects. Just the sheer magnitude of this nuclear buildup, given, you know, the lack of threats to Russia, is hard to imagine. Give us a sort of 30,000-foot level characterization of what Putin has been doing, the investment that he has been making, and what's been accompanying this that suggests that even crazier, perhaps, are the kinds of threats that he's making about using such stuff?
Well, Putin has a unique status in the world. He's the only president of a nuclear armed state that developed his own nuclear strategy. And the problem is, it's a really bad nuclear strategy. It involves the first use of nuclear weapons under circumstances that no one else would even consider their use. They call the introduction of nuclear weapons de-escalation of a war, which is reality turned on its head. He makes nuclear threats personally. His government makes nuclear threats all the time. His senior officials make nuclear threats all the time. He stages very provocative exercises involving the first use of nuclear weapons. I mean, apparently, and this is, you know, from Russians, Russian journalists, every major exercise conducted under Putin since about the year 2000 has gone nuclear with Russian introduction of nuclear weapons.
And he's often at the helm of those exercises, too. And let's recall some of these exercises, at the very least, Mark Schneider, I think I'm correct in saying, simulate nuclear attacks on the United States. Is that correct as well?
I mean, there are theater exercises and there are large strategic exercises, and the two sometimes combine. And in every instance, with the exception of the Far East exercises, some of which are against China, but certainly anything that's conducted in Europe, anything that's conducted with the large strategic force exercises, the ICBM force exercises, they're all against the United States. There's no question about that.
And Mark, when you look at the overall complexion of these modernization programs, again, the sheer magnitude of them, but also the kinds of capabilities that are now being introduced, the prospect that this strategic plan of Putin's could actually be executed with devastating effect against our country is, it seems, on the rise. Is that right?
Yes. There's no question about that. Since 2014, Russia has constantly been at war. It started with the annexation of the Crimea by force. It's continued in eastern Ukraine, where they have a thinly disguised military intervention by Russia, more than just providing aid and assistance. And U.S. officials have said this, actual involvement of Russian ground force units in the fighting in eastern Ukraine. And of course, what's going on in Syria, which, of course, has nothing to do with fighting terrorism, has to do with securing a Russian ally and Russian military bases, which they perceive, and this was stated by the defense minister, as a major change in the strategic situation in the Mediterranean. So we're in a situation where they are threatening NATO states, certainly every state in northern Europe and eastern Europe along the Baltic is threatened by, or perceives itself certainly as threatened by Russia. The Zapad 2017 exercise, I believe, was clearly play out of a Russian invasion of NATO Baltic states, and it apparently went nuclear.
Mark Schneider, lastly, just and very quickly, is there further evidence that the Russians are violating their obligations under not just the Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Treaty, but also the New START Accord? And if so, would you recommend, as I have, that we withdraw from those treaties as well?
Well, certainly, the INF treaty, where there are large-scale Russian violations, essentially the entire treaty is being violated. And the only way to deal with a problem that severe is withdrawal, and it would be very, very useful. On the STAR treaty, I think there are clear violations, but unfortunately, the State Department bureaucracy has basically circled the wagons around that treaty because they perceive it to be their baby. And we don't have, at this point, the intellectual basis to do a withdrawal. We've got to have a serious look at the compliance issues with the New START Treaty, which, by the way, as crazy as this sounds, the best source of information from this is Russian state media.
Not making much of a secret of their attitude towards this treaty. Mark Schneider, I'm not sure that there has been a serious look at Russian compliance issues since you left government, but at least within the government, I know you're doing your level best, for which we are deeply grateful. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Till then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.